Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Kurdistan Connection on Media News with myself, Matt Broomfield. As our listeners and followers will know, on this show we try to go a bit more in depth into some of the issues that we see in the headlines on Media News and on other news outlets covering the situation across Kurdistan, and particularly with the focus on the situation in Rojava or north and east Syria. Today we want to shift the focus just a little bit from that to the northwest of the country, to a region which I'm sure our listeners will be familiar with, but where the situation on the ground is a little bit complex, as Turkish forces have entered that region at a couple of points across the past 4 years, or longer ago actually, and established zones of occupation, working together with Turkish-backed groups and the Syrian National Army. Then you also have Idlib under the control of HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, an offshoot of Al-Qaeda, who are also active in Syria and fighting against the Damascus regime. It's a complicated situation there, and we've got a great guest today who will help us to understand some of the interesting recent developments between these kind of four, five, six or more forces on the ground, because we're also looking, of course, at the Kurdish-led forces. We're also looking even at Iran, Russia and American policy in the region as well. So it's a complicated situation, but I'm very happy to have with us today Alexander McKeever, who I'm sure many of you will be familiar with, not least from his great newsletter, which he publishes kind of on the situation across northern Syria, the Kurdish-led regions, the Turkish-held regions, and elsewhere. If you don't, you should check out his social media and subscribe to that. He also does some research projects along with the Syrians for Truth and Justice, another very important monitor, watchdog, and research organization working on the situation in northern Syria. And so, Alex, thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Thank you. So yeah, we've got a few, I guess, more kind of in-depth questions. But first, I think it would be good to give people a bit of an oversight. If we're talking about, let's say, particularly beginning with this region, Afrin, that was occupied by Turkey now almost 5 years ago, and taken out of the hands of the YPG and the Syrian Democratic Forces. What's the kind of situation on the ground there today? And what's changed in terms of HTS in that region lately?
Yeah, so when Turkey took over the region in 2018, it installed a mix of civilian and military actors on the ground. The military actors are the factions of the Syrian National Army, which are the Turkish proxy forces made up of opposition groups from different parts of Syria, sort of with different orientations. And Turkey's sort of reformatted these groups and created a new sort of institutional basis for them. Though this institutional framework is really exists more on paper than anything else. The groups are largely led by single individuals and their family members in a very sort of warlordish fashion, and are primarily concerned with securing resources, extracting money from the local economy, from local resources, etc. So there's the SNA factions. Then there's the different civilian bodies. There's the local councils, which are all tied to local provincial governments across the border in Turkey. For example, in Afrin, the local council is under the auspices of the Hatay governorship across the border. And there's other institutional players as well. There's the Turkish governors across the border have representatives within Afrin, within the other areas under Turkish control as well. Then there's, also the Syrian interim government, which is the broader umbrella which the local councils ostensibly fall under, but it's largely a political body outside the country that it doesn't have much of a say locally. So that was the situation before this past year. And then in late 2022, there was a series of infighting that started as just an intra-SNA affair. It actually started in El Bab, related to the assassination of a media activist there that was carried out by one of the factions, Furqat al-Hamza. And this crime was investigated by the 3rd Legion, which is primarily Al-Jabhah al-Shamiyyah, which is sort of the largest SNA faction in the area. And they used this investigation to basically to kick off fighting with Hamza as they're one of the main rivals of Shamiyyah, the 3rd Legion within the region. And so then HTS used this as a way to enter into Afrin and attempt to enter into the rest of SNA Turkish controlled areas, which they for a long time now, they've been seeking to expand their influence outside of Idlib and attempt to really unify all the opposition factions under the HTS brand. So yeah, you had this initial bout of infighting, and then you had this invasion that took a couple days. HTS advanced very quickly, entered the city of Afrin within, you know, 3 or 4 days. And this was done in coordination with several SNA factions, including Hamza, as I mentioned before, as well as Firkat al-Suleyman Shah, which is sort of the other main collaborator with HTS within this situation, and also one of the main rivals to the 3rd Legion.
And so, as you said, HTS have had their eye on unifying these opposition regions for some time. Why was it now that they could actually do that? They had a casus belli, but there's been infighting there for years and years. Why was this the turning point for HTS?
Well, these clashes that broke out were really, you know, just a great opportunity for HTS to come in. Because the rivalry between the 3rd Legion and several other SNA factions, Hamza, Suleyman Shah, and Sultan Murad, they weren't really active within the actual fighting. They mostly stayed neutral. Those several groups are the groups within the SNA that are closest to Turkey. And so they've always had this this rivalry with the 3rd Legion, because the 3rd Legion is the strongest and sort of most locally grounded of the opposition groups within within northwestern Syria. Their lineage comes from some of the earliest factions within the area, from the cities of Azaz, Maria, Tel Rifat. So they are, you know, strongest and most independent, not as reliant on Turkey as the other factions. So this rivalry had been brewing for years, and, you know, was really kicking off at this point. And so HTS saw this as the perfect opportunity to move in and, you know, try to stake out more of a claim to Afrin and potentially other parts of northwestern Syria.
And this was kind of HTS, we think, made this move, and Turkey was happy for it to happen. Turkey indicated that they weren't overly concerned about this, or what was the kind of degree of coordination, if any, between Turkey
I don't think there was coordination. Turkey's, you know, investment is really within these factions like Hamza, Sultan Murad, and within the SNA more broadly. While the Turkey is happy to sideline the 3rd Legion and, you know, take away their power and influence, it would be really, you know, to put that power in the hands of its more direct proxies. HTS, it has a relationship with HTS, but it's, you know, I think Turkey's strategy is somewhat piecemeal for these areas. And so it has its one strategy in Idlib where it works with HTS, but within the other areas, it's, you know, it has these other more direct proxies that it's happier to work with. But at the same time, Turkey did not want to intervene directly. It eventually, through negotiations, you know, had most of HTS withdraw its military forces, at least from the region, though it's maintained a security presence. But Turkey wasn't going to, you know, engage HTS militarily, because that would create a whole nother can of worms, really, within the Northwest.
So maybe kind of one question that I want to ask before I kind of return to that is just maybe you could sketch for people what's the difference between, for locals, between the HTS style of governance and governance under these Turkish proxies? Is life basically the same? How does it differ?
No, I think the main difference really is that HTS has a uniform security body. It's created the Salvation Government, which is its civilian administration, which runs Idlib, and it's It's former Nusra. They are hardline Islamists, Salafists, and so there are all these sort of rules like that. But at the same time, it is a uniform and sort of rationalized administration, whereas in the other areas of northwestern Syria, the security situation's incredibly chaotic. You have SNA factions, you have various police bodies, all sort of vying for sovereignty, basically. And then Turkey has the final say, but Turkey is sort of hands off when it comes to the military and civilian bodies within the other parts of the Northwest. So a lot of times, people don't necessarily like the HTS project, but in terms of, day-to-day life, it's just simply easier to live under one administration than a rivaling warlords, basically.
Yeah, certainly. And so kind of with that in mind then, so as you've said, HTS kind of entered with quite a strong show of force, but then withdrew quite a lot of their boots on the ground from Afrin following kind of Turkish intervention. Is this going to have resulted in much change for like average civilians or citizens still living in Afrin, or day to day, are things going to continue as they have done for the past few years?
Things appear to have continued largely the same way. So HTS currently, it's hard to really tell. Apparently they have left behind significant personnel from their security apparatus, and you hear reports about raids conducted largely against members of the Third Legion. At least that's what the reports say. The HTS raids that are carried out in Afrin. But again, through open sources and even through other reporting, it's quite hard to really tell what the extent is of the HTS presence. But meanwhile, the SNA, life under SNA rules sort of continued the way it has. Turkey, actually, one thing that's happened since these events in October of 2022 is that Turkey has put a little bit more effort, I think, into trying to reform the SNA. It's tried this for years, and it's, failed repeatedly because it doesn't ever disempower the various personalized leadership of these factions. So, it continues with this sort of warlord system. But it has been saying that it's going to turn over checkpoints to the military police, which also is implicated in another string of abuses, of kidnappings and torture, detentions. But this at least would, create a uniform system as opposed to what you have now, where factions use checkpoints for financial gain to arrest either people from other factions or civilians. So they're trying this reform process. We'll see how it goes. Again, I don't think it's really addressing the structural issues within the SNA, which is the fact that it's not a unified body. It's a collection of 30 militias, essentially. But yeah, long answer short, it doesn't seem to have really changed since HTS entered.
Yeah. So I think that then brings us to move discussion on from a sort of that helpful overview of the situation on the ground today in the region, to think about trends going forwards. So you said Turkey's been making these sort of tentative efforts at some kind of reform, at calming the situation down somewhat in the region, but practically it remains this kind of patchwork of warring militias, albeit the balance of power might have shifted there. What's Turkey's kind of long-term aim? Is Turkey happy for this kind of situation of, as you've said, sort of relative lawlessness with these groups fighting over whatever profits they can find and extracting what profits they can from the local population? Is Turkey happy for that to continue indefinitely? Does Turkey want to remain there? What's the long game here?
So I don't think Turkey necessarily has a long game. Their direct intervention in Syria, beginning in 2016, Operation Euphrates Shields, were really, there was two main goals in mind. There was preventing, the connection of the cantons, of the, autonomous administration, et cetera, whatever you want to call it back then. And then also further walking back the territorial gains of, you know, the SDF in general. And then also to prevent another influx of refugees into Syria or into Turkey, which essentially means freezing the lines of conflict, contact around Idlib, and prevent, because Idlib has the, you know, this massive IDP population and the remnants of the original Idlib population in there as well. So if the regime launched an offensive in Idlib and took it all the way to the border, you'd have like 3-4 million people flooding into Turkey, which is absolutely not what the Erdogan government wants right now, given how contentious the refugee issue has been. So Turkey entered Syria with these two goals in mind, but I don't think there was really a long-term plan. I don't, you know, people talk about like neo-Ottomanism, Turkey wanting to, you know, annex northern Aleppo. I don't think that's really what they have in mind at all. You know, that would also, you know, negating Syrian sovereignty and the sovereign borders doesn't really look good for Turkey as well, considering the 40-year conflict with the PKK, which, you know, to them is an issue of sovereignty and borders. So I don't think annexation is really on the table. But I don't
think there's not really financial. Sorry, just to, there's Turkey isn't making money from this occupation. No, it's costing Turkey money, and it's something more political than economic.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly Turkish contractors that are making money in terms of like construction companies and stuff. But the government itself, no, this is not like a financially beneficial project, really. It's really based on the two goals that I mentioned earlier, the walking back any Kurdish gains within Syria and preventing another refugee influx. So in a way, this is really where the current situation of reconciliation, I think that's where that really comes in. Because a potential reconciliation with the Assad regime would mean, you know, essentially wiping the map of the autonomous administration, returning Syria to all of northeastern, the Syrian government to all of northeastern Syria. It would also, you know, potentially freeze the borders. That's a little bit complicated with refugees and IDPs within Syria. But so this, the reconciliation process that's ongoing, it's, you know, I think very tentative early steps. And it's still a very complicated situation between the Turkish government's demands and what Damascus wants, et cetera. But I think that is sort of where we're headed. It's just, it's going to take a long time.
Yeah. And do we think then that is the one possible outcome of that these regions we've been talking about, the Euphrates Shield region, Afrin, that they're handed over directly to the Assad's regime? Is that some, as a part of that deal?
So that's definitely what Damascus wants. And I think Turkey envisions that in the long term. I think in the short term, it's very hard to see how that would happen. You know, the local populations absolutely do not want this to happen. A return to Damascus would mean, you know, a lot of them would be detained by the government, imprisoned, given, you know, either personal activities within the opposition, whether it's civilian opposition or military opposition, or just, you know, whether it's their family members that were involved, or just, you know, residing within these areas, I think is something that's liable to be punished by the regime itself. So in the short term, I don't really know how this is going to happen. And I don't think either of the parties involved do as well. But I think that Turkey sees it as it's in its long-term interests to do this. Also, there's also the issue of elections, which, you know, Erdogan has a big election coming up this year, and almost the entire Turkish opposition, they want to see reconciliation with the Assad regime, and what they really want to see is the deportation of the 3-4 million Syrian refugees within Turkey as well. So you also have to factor in the campaigning calculus of Erdogan right now when he's going through these reconciliation meetings. But long term, I think it is really the only way Turkey sees a way out of the current situation.
Yeah. So then, obviously, we've spoken generally about this, the present situation. which may well continue for some time, of this de facto occupation, these war militias remaining in place there, possibly also in the future moving towards some kind of handover, however that may work in practice, or partial handover to the Assad regime. Then on the other hand, we have the Kurdish-led autonomous administration in north and east Syria. Their perspective is they were able to offer the best governance to these regions, to Afrin anyway, and to the Peace Spring areas until they were taken off them by Turkey. They would like these regions to be returned to their governance. And this kind of tends to result in, you know, kind of appeals to international actors, to human rights organizations about the poor conditions there and arguing that they should be put in situ. Is there anything more that they can say or that they can do to try and work towards this goal? Or do they just have to sit back and wait for Damascus and Ankara to reach whatever deal they reach?
I think that the situation that the autonomous administration is in right now is very difficult. You know, they don't really have any international political backers. The United States is there in essentially a pure counterterrorism capacity. The U.S. is not going to leave anytime soon, but the reasons it's there is not to support the autonomous administration's governance project, but to prevent the return of ISIS and to somehow deal with the tens of thousands of ISIS fighters and family members that are currently detained within the autonomous administration prisons. So without, a primary international backer that's willing to support their political claims and willing to support them within negotiations for the future, I don't really see how the autonomous administration is going to be able to, expand its controls back to areas that it formerly governed. So I think that, everything's still sort of frozen the way it's been the last couple of years. You have this thaw in relations between the Syrian government and Turkey that's being facilitated by Russia. And then you have the U.S., which it's the counterterrorism mission, there is no clear end date. It can sort of continue indefinitely. And you have these statements by the State Department and various other U.S. officials saying that they do not support the reconciliation meetings between Erdogan and Assad. So they are sort of willing to sit there and obstruct for a while. But again, I think there's a sort of a limited timetable to how long that's going to go on.
Yeah. No, and when when my last question really related to that was, there's been these rumblings of another Turkish operation against those regions which do remain under the SDF and the autonomous administration. And might it then be likely, even if we don't see an operation on the east of the Euphrates, that Manbij and Tell Rifat, these regions might be sort of low-hanging fruit that the US is not too concerned about, doesn't see as particularly strategic, and would be willing to hand over for sort of the next stage of Turkey's operations in the region?
Yeah, so I know there were reports that the US, in its sort of negotiations with Turkey over this threatened operation, had tried to, point them towards Tell Rifat, saying that that was, to the US at least, that was, they didn't really have any opinions about that, but that they were opposed to Turkey moving into Kobani and apparently Manbij as well. Tell Rifat, the U.S. was never involved in that area. They were never involved in Afrin. The YPG, the SDF in Afrin, had a relationship with the Russians, but never coordinated with the U.S. Just geographically, it was impossible. So the U.S. has never been particularly invested in Tell Rifat. The regime and Iranian, the IRGC as well, and the Russians all have, a significant presence within Tell Rifat area. So they're way more invested than the U.S. was. Manbij is a little hard to tell because, the U.S. withdrew in 2019. I think Kobani, because it's all east of the Euphrates, it's sort of a contiguous area. The U.S. is apparently definitely does not want them to go into Kobani. Manbij, I don't really know. And in terms of the Russians, I think the Russians, it's sort of the opposite. Manbij is sort of hard to read. Tell Rifat, I think the Russians definitely don't want a Turkish advance there, given just the how close it is to Aleppo. Whereas Kobani, I think, is possibly more on the table for the Russians. The overall, you know, there was, I was reading a piece by Sam Heller recently for War on the Rocks that was just pointing out that Turkey's really, or Russia's really the one that sort of controls the traffic lights for these operations. He was saying that the U.S. Isn't really able to tell Turkey yes or no, whereas the relationship that Erdogan and Putin have is Erdogan listens more to Putin and is willing to deal with him more at this point. And then Russia, according to this analysis, at least, Russia was really the ones that stopped this operation. But the way it stopped was also to try to get them to go into this reconciliation process. So, you know, potentially if this reconciliation process doesn't go anywhere, we might see a Turkish operation somewhere. It's, you know, these kind of things are quite hard to read. They're all sort of
negotiations. Until it happened, and then everyone knew what was going to happen all along.
Yeah. But maybe, anything that's like diplomatic backdoor stuff, it's hard to say.
For sure. Yeah, maybe then just to kind of close this discussion at the start of this year, you've touched on this already. Looking to just the year ahead, let's say, do you have any kind of general predictions that you'd like to share for the northeast, the northwest of Syria? What's going to change? Is everything going to stay the same?
I really don't want to make any predictions. people always make predictions and then it doesn't really end up too well. But there's definitely a number of things I'm like watching right now. The reconciliation process is definitely one. This is particularly interesting given that there's no constituency within the populations within Turkish control for reconciliation. So you have millions of people living under Turkish and SNA control, and then also the SNA groups as well that are quite opposed to reconciliation. Though, like, you know, the SNA groups at the moment will make statements saying they're opposed to reconciliation, but won't actually name Turkey. But anyway, this is something that Erdogan feels is necessary, at least in the short term, for election purposes, but, you know, draws large protests every time it gets talked about in the media in northern Syria. In Deir ez-Zor, I think, in terms of the autonomous administration, there's been quite high tensions throughout the year. Sort of local dissatisfaction, I think, with, you know, just how the autonomous administration overall is in a quite difficult space economically, that, you know, it essentially has no open borders. You know, it trades with the regime and trades with the SNA a bit, and then, you know, the border with Iraqi Kurdistan's, you know, constantly closed, open, whatever. So these economic issues have been had political ramifications, particularly within Deir ez-Zor, where there's been there's also sort of cultural and political factors at play that have created significant unrest, and unrest with the Deir ez-Zor Military Council in particular, the body of the SDF. So that's a situation that I'm watching right now. Obviously, you know, the threats of a Turkish operation, and then also the Turkish drone campaign, which is continuing and continues to target civilian and military targets alike. And, unfortunately, it's killed a significant number of civilians over the past year.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Alex. It was really great. I think especially for a lot of our viewers that are more familiar with the Kurdish side of things, then the temptation is to see the Northwest and these groups as kind of a monolith, kind of one single block. So to explore a bit some of the internal politics there and how that relates to these wider questions is very helpful. So, yeah, thank you again to Alex McKeever for joining us today. And as we mentioned at the start, you really should, of course, subscribe to his newsletter, which is on Substack, if I'm correct.
It's akmckeever.substack.com.
Yeah, for a kind of regular look at some of the things which, the big topics and also things which don't always make the news across northern Syria in this region, which is so important for these issues we've discussed today. So thank you again to Alex.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Take care. This has been the Kurdistan Connection with myself, Matt Broomfield. Until the next episode, goodbye.